The following is a presentation of Second City Works, delivered by your earbuds at WGN Plus.
Welcome to the Second City Works, Getting to Yes And. I'm Kelly Leonard, Executive Director of Insights and Applied Improvisation for the world-famous Second City Theater. This is more than just a podcast. It's about getting to the yes and moment in your work and in your life. Yes and is a key pillar of improvisation. It operates at the front end of creativity. It's about building on ideas and navigating change. This is Getting to Yes And.
Working all day for a mean little man with a clip on tie and a rub on tan. He's got me running around the office like a dog around a track. But when I get back home, you're always there to rub my back. Hey, Julie, look what.
My guest today on Getting to Yes And is Mitch Prinstein. Mitch is the John Van. You know what? I'm going to start over because I wanted to ask you about this. Is it John Van Setters or Cedars?
I think it's Cedars.
That's what I thought.
They never told me.
Oh. Bastards. All right, I'm starting over. Here we go.
Okay.
My guest today on Getting to Yes And is Mitch Prinstein. Mitch is the John Van Cedars Distinguished Professor of Psychology and the Director of Clinical Psychology at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. He and his research have been featured in the New York Times, the Wall Street Journal, Time, NPR, and CNN. He is the author of the new book, Popular, The Power of Likeability in a Status-Obsessed World. Mitch, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me.
I want to start our conversation with an annual experiment that you run with your students who are enrolled in your class on popularity. And so on the first day of this experiment, your students are asked to wear normal clothing while they keep a written record of their social interactions and their mood as they walk around campus. And then on day two, you make a change. Tell us about that.
Oh, it's amazing to see what happens. All we do is we ask the students to wear a different shirt. It's a shirt that is meant to be loud, to make you seem visible and basically popular for a day.
Mm-hmm.
And the kids undergo a transformation. It's not just the case that everybody treats them differently. Of course they do. They're wearing a loud, usually obnoxious shirt that we pick in some sort of color that's going to blind any passerby. It's how much that the kids themselves change as a result of the attention that they receive. And the experiment is designed to help us understand what it's like to be popular and how it changes our lives.
And you guys, I guess psychologists call this a transactional model?
That's right. The transactional model really suggests that we are the product of a constant give and take of interactions between ourselves and the environment. We put something out there, the environment responds to that, and then we respond to that response in such a way where if you're popular, for instance, then all day long you're receiving positive overtures. People are saying hello, they're smiling at you, and the world seems like a really fun, friendly place where you get to learn new things. But on the flip side, if you're unpopular, then you're constantly being met with frowning and social rejection and lost opportunities. And research shows that that's why popularity changes us decades later.
So I've been walking around with your book for a week or two, and from my home conversations with my wife to colleagues, people go, huh, what's that about? Like, is there a downside to popularity? And I'm like, actually, and you write in, quote, what we've learned is that popularity is something of a paradox. It is fundamental to human nature to desire to be more popular, but that doesn't mean that being popular is always good for us. So how can there be a downside to popularity?
Oh, well, that's a great question. I would love for everybody to know that there are actually two kinds of popularity. Hmm. There's one kind that's really good for you. In fact, even three-year-olds can recognize who is the most popular in this way, and I'm referring to likability. Yeah. It's those kids who are kind to others, who really care about joining groups and leading those groups, not by dominating or by making others feel worse about themselves, but really helping for the team to kind of do well as a group. Those folks, the ones who are able to be likable in that way, they do better on every dimension you can think of. Even 30, 40 years later, research studies show they're healthier, they make more money, they're happier, they have better relationships. But there's a second kind of popularity, and that's what I refer to as status in the book. It's the kind of popularity we know a lot more about these days where there's such a focus on things like who's most visible or who has the most influence or the most celebrity. And it turns out that the people who have that tend to do much worse in the long run.
I really enjoyed your story about this, where you talk about, I'm going to butcher his name, I'm sure. I think it's Ignaz Semmelweis, who is a doctor.
That's right.
All right, not bad. So this guy, right, he discovered that mothers were being infected because doctors weren't washing their hands. Like stuff that is like so common, but this guy like discovered it. But even with all his status and influence, his popularity, he didn't do well, right? And he kind of left in shame.
Yeah, and ironically, he himself died from an infection, it's reported.
Wow.
He was a good example of what we've all come to know, especially recently, about what it's like when somebody is very focused on their power and how much everyone reveres them and looks up to them. But he's kind of a mean guy. He was aggressive. He was rude. He made it very clear that anyone who didn't agree with him was an idiot, was someone who was not worthy of his time. These are quotes translated from his own language. And even though he was popular in the way that we would think about status, he was not very well liked at all. And he's a classic example of somebody who did pretty poorly, not just because he passed away, but he actually was mocked and ridiculed. And people stopped following his medical advice because they didn't like him very much.
It's interesting. We've talked to so many fascinating people on this podcast, and research from various different areas seems to be saying the same thing. And I'm thinking of Dacre Keltner's work talking about power and generosity leading to power, but then a corrupting, or Adam Grant's work, or Emma Seppala, and essentially that, you know, in fact, like those good manners things are important. Listening is important. Caring about your fellow human being is important as a way for you to be successful in life.
Well, I agree, and thank you for comparing my work to theirs. I really look up to so many of those folks. I think it does make a lot of sense that this is a conclusion a lot of people are coming to. If you really think about it, you know, how much do you take for granted the person who's likable, that they must have other admirable qualities? How much do we want to believe and hire and promote and work with and date or marry those people who are likable? They get a pass, a halo effect on so many different areas of life just by being likable. Yet it's not something we talk about a lot. We think about popularity as something that we stopped thinking about in high school, but it's not true. Being likable is something that gives you an advantage all the time in all of our contexts.
So I think most people's response when they looked at the cover of your book in my office was sort of like, well, is he talking about kids? And I'm like, well, he's talking about both, right? We're talking about what happens when we're kids and we're adults. And I found this fascinating because you say at age 9, high-achieving children are typically the best liked of all. But 6 years later, those same kids reported precipitous declines in their emotional well-being. How does that happen?
Yeah, well, a lot of us can relate to that, right?
Uh-huh.
I mean, the really high-achieving, smart kid who suddenly goes from cool to nerd overnight, it seems like. You know, what happens is that nothing's changed in these kids, but the world has changed around them.
Mm.
So when you're a kid, being cool is doing what adults want you to do. Kids like to emulate their teachers and their parents, and that earns you regard among your peers, too. But everyone who's been an adolescent remembers that the last thing you want to do to seem cool as a teenager is to do what your parents want you to do. And parents still want you to get good grades, but the definition of cool is the ability to kind of meet the values of whatever group you're in and seem to do it effortlessly. In adolescence, it's all about doing what peers want you to do and stopping your interest in adults. In fact, there's some really interesting research that shows that there's something about the way that our brains develop in adolescence that actually makes us more attracted to our peers and kind of biologically makes us think our parents are uncool. Even mice tend to prefer to hang out with adolescent mice when they themselves are in adolescence than to hang out with other adult mice. We are biologically programmed to want to shun our parents at around that age.
Interesting. Is that because we need to start moving towards independence?
That's what people think. I think the idea being that it's important for our survival to know how to live without relying on our parents and spending the rest of our lives in their basements, right? Mm-hmm. We need to be able to leave the home and know how to fight for our own food and how to care for others. We're biologically perhaps built to kind of promote that activity and get us excited about hanging out with peers more.
Okay, so I understand, you know, how the six-year-old nerd becomes totally uncool when he or she becomes 13. But then you also note that there's studies that cool kids, when they're age 13, they don't fare much better when they get older.
No, they don't. They don't. Some great research has been done on this topic, including research by Joe Allen at University of Virginia, where he was able to follow kids from those early teen years well into their 30s. And what he finds is that those who are most cool, who are most interested in their status and their popularity, they grow up still caring about their popularity, still thinking that it's important to have high status. They pick romantic partners based more on their attractiveness. When they're broken up with, inevitably, in many cases, they actually believe that it's because they weren't popular enough for their mates. They have problems with addictions, keeping a job as long as others, and they even tend to, and these same kids tend to have difficulties having quality friendships. Their friends report that they don't enjoy being friends with these formerly cool kids very much anymore.
Wow, that's really interesting. Okay, I want to talk, you have a lot on status. And this is of particular interest, I think, to folks in the improvisational field and even the acting field, because status becomes such an elemental thing, into comedy as well. You know, classic sort of two men, you know, Laurel and Hardy and Hope and Crosby, and there's always sort of status play. But when you're improvising, establishing and surrendering status becomes a skill that you learn. And you write in here that, quote, status is not a measure of how well-liked a person is, but rather of his or her dominance, visibility, power, and influence. Interesting, status does not become salient to us until we reach adolescence. So how does status not play a part before then?
So it's interesting. I mean, people really think that there's something about our pubertal development mm-hmm. that creates different kinds of neurotransmitters at different levels and different ways of our brain picking up on this in a way that, again, prepares us for us to become independent from our parents. And it supercharges a part of our brain referred to as the ventral striatum, which gives us a high from social rewards. And around in adolescence, that reward center starts to become very activated to any sign of being visible, of being powerful and influential. Earlier than that, there's only one way to get that reward center to activate from a social experience, and that is more likability. But later on, and perhaps now especially in the world of social media, it's become all too easy to scratch that itch by doing things that just make us seem famous or visible.
Right. So you tell a really interesting and talk about a study that Professor Don Merton ran with a group of high school cheerleaders.
That's right.
So he talks about a thing called, and I'd never heard this term before, proactive aggression. So how does that play out when he's like observing these cheerleaders?
So when you watch adolescents, as Don Merton did, you notice that there are some kids that are being aggressive because someone just made them upset and they're frustrated and they're angry. And that's what we refer to as reactive aggression. It's the way that a lot of us get angry if we can't meet a goal that we have. But there were other kids that are being aggressive on purpose, just in a strategic, cold-blooded way, just to try and gain more status, to get a little bit higher on the social hierarchy. And when Don spoke with those kids and asked them, why do you do this? He asked the cheerleaders, why are you aggressive when you know that people will call you stuck up? They said, we have to. It's the only way to maintain the sanctity of our popularity. There will be no such thing as a high group unless we push everyone else down, unless we demonstrate that we are elite and exclusive. And the easiest way to do that is to become aggressive towards anyone that comes close to our boundary.
But it's impossible to maintain that level of, I mean, we see this play out pursuing it right now on a national stage or international stage, but to maintain that level of ungenerous high status is just that's dictators, right? I mean, it doesn't seem to play out well in other scenarios.
You're right. And it's also very lonely.
Yeah.
You know, ultimately, it's a lifestyle of trying so hard to feel better than and more powerful than everybody else that there's ultimately nobody who is really connected to that person anymore. And celebrities will say that, you know, they feel that there's a persona that they need to maintain to keep up that image, but it's not who they really are. So in the celebrities that have been interviewed, and I talk about this a little bit in the book as well, will say that they feel they have to create a split persona, one that helps to maintain their status, and then another one that fewer and fewer people actually know. And that part of them is the part that they feel most connected to, but is most alone.
Hmm. Yeah. You also, well, someone in my office actually said to me, hey, did they study status, but in different cultures? And you did. You did. There was a research of studying 15-year-olds in the United States and China. And there's a difference, right?
Yeah, it's really interesting that in westernized nations like here in the U.S., there's something that we value about having high status, it seems. We even have ways of talking about it in our language. But when we did the research in China, they didn't have a word for popularity that was the same. They had a word for celebrity. But the idea of extending that concept to those of us who are not celebrities and talking about that form of popularity, it was a bit more foreign to them. What was also, I thought, really interesting was that here in America, being aggressive gave you more status. But in China, being cooperative was what gave you more of their version of status. It really seemed to reflect different values between the West and the East.
Yeah, yeah. Sense of community, respect for elders. I mean, there's so much that's different between our two cultures.
Absolutely. I mean, this kind of collectivistic society, you know, versus more of a, you know, the American dream, kind of a way of becoming rich and famous,
yeah.
You know, all by yourself and dominating those around you.
You know, we talk about that a lot on this podcast because, you know, we're constantly fighting this idea about the sort of lone myth of the sole creative, that there's one person who's going to solve everything for you. And, you know, we come from a pedagogy and a philosophy around ensembles and groups and that all of us are better than one of us, which doesn't seem to jive with the American dream, but in fact has proven itself over and over and over again in so all facets of our culture, really, when you look at the facts.
Well, you're absolutely right. And, you know, you see those two types of popularity play out in teams and in corporate America all the time. You've got those people who are most interested in knowing that it was their idea, that they were the team leader, and they want to take credit. Those leaders can be effective. They mm-hmm. can produce work within their teams, but they are hated, and they're leading through a power dynamic, a power assertive dynamic that creates dissatisfaction and less buy-in from the team for the next project. Likeable leaders are just as successful, but they have long-standing effects. The team feels like they work together. It's more about the group working as a whole, and that leads to greater sustained improvement and buy-in for the entire corporation. It's a really important distinction when it comes to thinking about leadership.
Yep. So we have a partnership with the Center for Decision Research at Chicago Booth, and Nick Epley is like our scholar. And I've got this ongoing argument with him because the improv world feels very strongly that they can connect nonverbally, that they have a great, incredible gift for understanding what others are thinking because of this practice of improvisation. And Nick doesn't believe any of it because he thinks all his studies show that we wildly overestimate our ability to perceive anything that's going on. But one thing that we actually do agree on is that we know that asking a lot of questions is a way that you get to truth. And you talk about this. You say studies show that people who ask many questions of each other when they first meet is a highly effective way of scanning for an emotional connection, and they're more likely to have high-quality relationships even months later.
Yeah, I think that's a fascinating bit of the research. I'm glad you brought it up. Thank you.
Mm-hmm.
They did a really cool study where they looked at folks who became friends, but they had access to videotape from the times when they first met, and they tried to look back on those videotapes and say, What were those first initial interactions that predicted which groups became friends with each other and which pairs of folks did not? And they did find there was something really important about asking questions of one another, that way of not trying to insert yourself as being the most important in the dynamic or, you know, really trying to monopolize the conversation, but someone who is truly interested in connecting with others and finding that point of common interest. And that experience led not only to finding something they had in common, but a shared emotional experience that became the basis for friendship. And I think it's cool what you're saying, that you know, also works in so many other domains, that asking questions and sharing together ultimately becomes far more important than trying to keep the spotlight on yourself.
Yeah, it's tricky because when beginning improvisers, when they start, we always tell them not to ask questions because you can just end up asking your scene partner all these questions and they're doing all the work. But in fact, what you really want to do is plumb the depths of the relationship because you're making it up. So you kind of you really want to fill in those blanks. And the thing that I found interesting when I read that part of your book is that I think what happens is usually the beginnings of our conversations are a waste of time and people are just sort of throwing words out there. And there's a terrific phrase in our work that you need to start in the middle because that's where the good stuff happens. And in fact, if you can maintain those conversations for longer than normal, and especially now in the world we live in, which is so disconnected and people aren't having face-to-face conversations, you're going to discover so much more, especially if you're paying attention. And I think the longer you're in a conversation, the likelihood that you're actually paying attention probably rises.
I think that makes perfect sense. And, you know, what we find with the most likable people is that they truly convey a sense of wanting to know the people that they're speaking with, and they're excited about what they're hearing. They help people feel welcomed into the herd, as it were, and really make them feel like they're an important, valued member. And that kind of small talk at the beginning of the conversation, it's harder to convey that. That feels like elevator talk. But when you get to that middle, you're really able to talk about things of substance. And when you relate to somebody on that level, it makes them feel far more important and included.
Yeah, we had a guest, Scott Curran, who was worked for the Clinton Global Foundation. He came by the office the other day for a conversation, and he was just talking about Bill Clinton's ability to engage and ask you questions and make you feel like you were the center of the room. And this was something, obviously, he did writ large with all the people who voted for him. But you look at all the great leaders, right? And they have that ability to sort of narrow in and make you feel like you are the most important person in that room, not them.
Absolutely. And that really defines the best leaders. You know, when people talk about the CEOs that they love and that they feel most aligned with, it's for that exact reason, because that CEO, no matter where you are in the corporate hierarchy, still knew who you were and knew your name and was interested in you and took the time to get to know each of their employees. You don't just get someone complying with the tasks that are asked of them. You get someone aligned as an employee who wants to follow the CEO. And I think it's exactly what you're saying about Bill Clinton. It's someone who took the time to really want to get to know people and connect with them.
Mm-hmm. Now, I think that unpopularity can be seen as widely negative, but you actually point out there are some benefits to being unpopular.
That's true. There's more and more research showing that although those folks who are unpopular do suffer consequences, there are some negative things that come along with that. They may be particularly skilled in perspective taking, in empathy, being able to anticipate rejection. You want to have some people who used to be unpopular around you in any group. They are very valuable.
That also seems to jive with some of the research in scarcity. That talks about poor people having a far greater understanding of what's actually going on.
That's right. That's exactly right. There's something about being low in status, whether it's popularity or it's your socioeconomic status, that helps you to be more in tune with realism and the possibility of negative outcomes. There's an interesting concept in psychology referred to as depressive realism that's shown that some people who are depressed actually have a better take on the objective state of their their environment than people who are not depressed and have an overly rosy picture of their surroundings.
I think artists probably keyed into this before scientists. If you think about Shakespeare's Fool and, you know, and even I was thinking about it in a contemporary context when I first read this, I was thinking like Kaiser Sose, you know, or various characters from, you know, contemporary film who, you know, appear to be the lowest. They make themselves lower status, but they do that on purpose as a, you know, a strategy.
Yeah, that's a great point. I think that's real. I mean, I think that, you know, if a lot of us really thought about all of the risks and all of the negative possibilities around us, it could be quite depressing. But it serves us well to have biases in life, whether those are positive or negative biases. We've been reinforced for them. We've been taught that, you know, thinking about the world in a very rosy place works for us. And for some, thinking about the negative consequences and the possible rejection, it works for them. Think of the kid who was bullied for their entire childhood. It's important for them to anticipate rejection. Otherwise, they would be foolish. They would be at risk. So there's a way in which those biases we all have really are important to pay attention to.
So this is tough stuff because it happens to us when we're young and it sticks with us for the most part. And that's any of the conversations I had around the office were that. Everyone, I mean, immediately people are like, that's me. I, you know, terrible. Yeah, rough time. Another person was like, you know what? I was popular and it served me well. So how do you, okay, let's say you're one of the neglected or rejected, which are two of the sort of areas you talk about. How do you make that not take over your adult relationships to make you unhappy in your adult life?
Oh, that's a great question. I think it's really important for people not to try and sweep this under the rug and think that they're able to, you know, just move on to college or their jobs and start all over. It's not true. We now have evidence from neuroscience showing us exactly how often we call upon these old memories when we think about, when we even look at things today. So I think the first step is to really just be honest with where we came from in terms of popularity and what experiences are still part of our social filters today. I think the second step is to make a conscious choice and decide, do you want to be popular, and what kind of popularity? So many people think they will make up for those negative childhood experiences by becoming famous or wealthy, and that's not the correct answer in most cases. It's more about being likable. And third and last, I would say, once you are making the decision to invest in likability, to regard every interaction you have as an opportunity to start over. Because as you mentioned earlier on, the transactional model, the idea that we have a give and take with our environment, it suggests that even the simplest little social interactions can produce a chain reaction, and everyone can start that today. They could start it in the next few minutes, smiling at somebody, offering a friendly greeting, making a joke, extending a courtesy, can immediately change the way the environment treats us, which changes the way that we want to interact in the next few minutes, and so on.
Yeah, completely true. Okay, we're coming close to the end, and I am going to ask you for a yes and story. It's the way we always end this podcast, where you think of a moment in your life or career where you normally would say no, and but you said yes and. But before we do that, I did. There was one note here that I did want to talk to you about, which is, how is it that men, when they're 16 and they're tall, go on to earn more money?
Isn't that interesting? It's
yes.
Not so much how tall you are as an adult. That research showed that it was how tall you were at 16 that predicted how much money you made, even more so. And interestingly, that has something to do, likely, with popularity. There's something about those experiences we have at that age that sticks with us. It's like it stays a part of our soul forever. Ask anybody what their adolescence was like or what their popularity experiences were like, and they talk about it as if it happened yesterday. There's something so special about popularity that really stays as an important part of who we are. And did it make these kids more confident? Did it get them involved in more activities? Did it get them picked for more leadership kinds of experiences? I don't know. We need more research on that. But it certainly is really telling that there's something magical about those adolescent years that remain a part of who we are forever.
Yeah, and it wasn't tall women, right? It was just tall men.
This study only looked at men.
Yeah, yeah. Well, that made some sense to me, because I was thinking back, and I was talking to my son about it, who's 19, and I'm like, who are the tallest, you know, and he was one of them, of the tallest in his class at that age. And there was, at that period, I remember in his class, that he and his friend Connor, who was also tall, and his twin sister were sort of, they assumed a kind of leadership role. People literally looked up to them, and they had more eye contact with their teachers. So there was more of a sort of peer-to-peer relationship that seemed to develop at that time. But I do think it's maybe a little bit different for women in terms of how they are treated societally.
I think you're right. Yeah. That's a really good point.
So, all right. So, yes and story. You're at the university. You worked your way up to this sort of prominent position. But, you know, there's a lot of choices that you make in your life and your career. So I'm wondering if you've got a moment that might have been a no, but instead was a yes and what happened?
Oh, you know, I'm sure there have been a lot professionally, but the one that probably had the biggest impact on my life was a personal yes and. Mm-hmm. And it was how I met my wife. I was... my wife and I were fixed up by my brother and her college roommate from about 800 miles away. Uh-huh. And I had never been set up before by my brother, and she hadn't ever been recommended anyone from her college roommate. And neither of us are anything like the people who set us up. But I know for me, I was done with dating for a little while. I was a hard no. Mm-hmm. I did not want to kind of start all over with someone who I probably had nothing in common with from what I thought. But I said yes, and I went further than that. I said, not only am I going to say yes, but I'm not going to decide on the first date. I'm going to go ahead and keep on going until I thought I would rather stay home alone than go out with this person anymore. And it didn't take that long. I fell in love with her on the first date, and I only would have done that. I never would have done that had I not said yes, and.
I love it. That's a great story. The book is called Popular. Everyone should get it. It's really smart, really cool. Mitch Prinstein, thank you for joining us on the show.
Thank you so much.
Well, I've been working in a coal mine, going down. Working in a coal mine, about to slip down. Working in a coal mine, going down. Working in a coal mine, about to slip down. 5 o'clock in the morning, I'm up before the sun. When my work day is over, too tired for having fun. I've been working in a coal mine, going down. Working in a coal mine, about to slip down. Working in a coal mine, going down. Working in a coal mine, about to slip down.
Lord, I am so tired. How long can this go on?
Well, I've been working. Working in a coal mine, going down, down. Working in a coal mine, going down, down. Working in a coal mine.